Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Systems Change Deep Dive podcast, where we take a systemic look at some of the greatest social, economic, and environmental challenges that we are facing as a global community, and also at the ideas and projects that have the potential to catalyze systems change. We are currently looking into the issue of carbon capture as a response to the climate crisis, and throughout the previous episodes of this series, we have been hearing from experts around the world that are working on different approaches and solutions to carbon capture and beyond. Today, we have with us Professor Peter McCready, who is a marine scientist and global leader in blue carbon. His research focuses on understanding and responding to the impacts of global change on aquatic ecosystems, and he has a multidisciplinary approach to research spanning the fields of chemistry, ecology, microbiology, economics, policy, and molecular biology. He is the founder and head of Deakin University's Blue Carbon Lab and holds the position of professor in marine science. He's also the chair of the Independent Scientific Advisory Board for the National Decommissioning Research Initiative. Peter McCready is actively involved in translating science into policy, so he currently sits on the Victorian Coastal Council Science Panel, the Australian Academy of Sciences Future Earth, Oceans and Coasts Expert Working Group, and the Australian Government's Blue Carbon Expert Working Group. He has published over 170 peer-reviewed papers and received millions in research funding and also 25 awards and fellowships. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here today. And I'd like to start off the interview by asking you what pulled you towards this type of work, what inspired you to work in blue carbon and ecosystem restoration?
I had just finished my PhD and I had felt that my PhD wasn't what I'd achieved was interesting from an academic perspective, but it wasn't leading to real world impact. And this might sound a little bit depressing, but I think a lot about, you know, when I die and have I achieved anything that's been genuinely useful for society? And I figured I wanted to try and do more in my science to have real world impact, to improve lives and livelihoods. And I was doing something that didn't make me feel too inspired. And I came across two words, blue carbon, one day. It was a colleague of mine, who Carlos Duarte, who had written, contributed to a report that was led by some pretty reputable NGOs about blue carbon. And I thought, even if this is half right, this is amazing. This could be a real game changer for conserving and restoring wetlands around the world. And from that point on, you know, I really fell in love with blue carbon and have researched it ever since and built my career to this date around blue carbon.
Maybe you could go a little bit into your approach to this issue of carbon capture.
Yeah, okay. So I think that for me, carbon drawdown is a no-brainer. You know, you take carbon out of the ground and it's used to fuel our lifestyles, whether it's, you know, turning on a light, driving down the street, whatever. And it's simply a matter of grabbing some of that carbon that ultimately ends up in the atmosphere and putting it back in the ground. And I think we, you know, like to feel like we're paying for our carbon sins through offsets. You know, we release a ton of CO2 and we, you know, offset a ton of CO2. But what I found was that a lot of those offsets, they're not like for like. You know, you're taking a fossil fuel that's been in the ground for thousands of years, and you're maybe trying to offset it by planting, let's say, a tree. And a trees are amazing. They're so important, but we want to have long-term carbon drawdown. We want to be basically putting carbon back in the ground again for thousands of years. And I think that's what, for me, struck me about blue carbon ecosystems as being really special, that they are the same ecosystems that created fossil fuels in the first place. They're a form of very long-term carbon drawdown. So blue carbon ecosystems, for any listeners who might not be familiar with them, well, they're seagrass meadows, they're tidal marshes, they're mangrove forests, and to some unknown extent, seaweeds play an important role as well. And these three ecosystems only occupy less than 1% of the seafloor, yet they sequester more than half the ocean's carbon. And so when we say, what is blue carbon? Well, it's actually carbon that is captured and stored by our coasts and oceans broadly. But most of us refer to these ecosystems because they're doing a lot of the heavy lifting. They're the ones that are the key contributors to carbon drawdown.
And I'm a little bit curious also because I was looking at the Blue Carbon Lab website and you have a lot of different activities that you engage in. And I saw something that I'd never seen before, which was teal carbon. So I'd love to hear from you a little bit about that as well.
Teal carbon, it's probably not a term that is well known yet, but it's basically carbon that is captured and stored by freshwater wetlands. I'm not even sure, you know, in the same way that the term blue carbon just arose, I'm not sure that teal carbon is an official scientific term. It's simply a term that people can rally around as a way of describing, you know, there's brown carbon, there's black carbon, there's blue carbon, there's teal carbon, there's green carbon.
Okay, so and the Blue Carbon Lab has having so many activities. Maybe I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the environmental impacts of the different things that you're doing, any kind of side effects, mostly positive, I guess, not any negative, but if there are any negative impacts, please feel free to address them as well.
So as a lab, much like you asked me about what I wanted to do in my career and what got me onto Blue Carbon, that philosophy around having real world impact is something that all the lab have rallied around. That's something that has united us. We want to have impact in the communities we serve, not just within the academic community. And it's sometimes that separates us from some other of other university research groups, perhaps a little bit to our advantage, maybe, in that, you know, people I think are attracted to those who are trying to strive for impact in the real world. We have another commitment, which is to bring our clients and our partners along through the process and demystify what we do. And at the moment, we have six main research themes that the team supports. We've got the Blue Carbon and Teal Carbon program. There's one on citizen science, bring up that point there about bringing people along with us in the journey. And we found that these immersive experiences through citizen science often change behavior towards the environment and the way people run their lives. And I think that is leading to some important changes in the way people live. We have one that's on valuing ecosystem service. So this ecosystem services, so what nature does for us, whether that's coastal protection or providing fisheries or healthy waters and so on. And then a growing theme for us is on restoration and conservation of these ecosystems. There's a theme on microplastics. I'm staggered recently by some of the recent research that's been coming out, including by one of my postdocs, Tanvir, who's found that average Australian shamefully produces 59 kilos of single-use plastic each year, and only 18% of that is recycled. And we started this research because a lot of it's ending up in coastal wetlands, the blue carbon ecosystems. By 2035, we estimate that there'll be 14,000 million metric tons of plastic in coastal wetlands. That's about as much that's about the same quantity as the amount of carbon that's in these wetlands. And then the final theme is on decommissioning of offshore oil and gas structures. There's a lot of oil and gas structures offshore that are reaching the end of their production life. They're due for decommissioning. Gulf of Mexico alone, there's 4,000 jackets and 37,000 kilometers of pipeline, which is almost enough to do an entire circumference of the planet Earth. And the liability of decommissioning those structures is quite high. Australia alone, $50 billion over the next 50 years. And so one of the challenges we have is making a decision about whether or not we should remove these structures as is currently legislated around many parts of the world, or in fact, whether they should be left in the oceans. And you probably think, well, why on earth would you do that? Why on earth would you allow an oil and gas company to leave pipelines and jackets in the ocean? And here's where it gets complicated. We have found that some of the highest densities of fish in the world occur on these structures. We found, you know, there's endangered corals and, rare species, and it's become complicated because we need to understand, well, what if we did leave them in the oceans? What is the impact, both positive and negative, on marine life? How do people feel about this? What impacts might that have, positive and negative, on our economy? So it gives you a sense for the breadth of research. It started as Blue Carbon, but then, of course, as we come across other problems as a team that we feel like we can make a valuable contribution to, we've developed new research profiles within Blue Carbon Lab.
And is it easy to integrate all of these different topics together?
Well, you know, we've got stuff happening in the deep ocean with decommissioning, and then, you know, you come into the shore and we're in, you know, muddy wetlands at the interface between land and sea with blue carbon. And then we end up in fresh water, sometimes all the way up to alpine lands doing work on peat systems in the mountains. So it's tremendous diversity. And I think that's what makes it so exciting. And fortunately, as a team, we've built quite a lot of capacity as a group, spanning environmental economics and biogeochemistry, microbiology, ecology, molecular biology modeling, and so on. And I think what, you know, really gets my blood pumping is being able to work with such a diverse team. And I don't want to make it sound like we're doing this all alone. You know, we have amazing collaborators around the world who we partner with within academia and outside of academia, industry and governments. So it's really exciting when you can have, you know, large multidisciplinary teams to tackle big research questions.
Yeah, that definitely sounds exciting. And it's interesting that you mention environmental economics, because I was going just about to ask you how do you feel that your activities in kind of integrate with local economic activities and other activities?
We've realized and are pragmatic about the way the world works, and money is a big part of that. And money effectively can dictate decisions that people make in their everyday life. Environmental economics is fundamentally about people. And so whenever we do work, it's what is the business case for nature? How can we appeal to people? Some are maybe financially motivated, some are motivated for other reasons, just, you know, nature is just a beautiful thing and we want to try and preserve it. There's something you know, intrinsically important about it for others. So when we create the business case, we often want to look at the cost and benefits to society. And if it cannot be currently supported through markets, market-based mechanisms, we often want to look at other levers we can pull to try and rally finance for conservation and restoration, because that's, you know, one of the biggest challenges we've got is preserving nature and conserving nature and restoring nature. And if you think about, I've mentioned carbon markets a few times now, carbon markets are really just one financial tool to rally finance for nature-based solutions to climate change. You know, there's so many other ways of achieving carbon mitigation and rallying finance for conservation. You know, there's blue bonds, there's covenanted tax deductions, there's environmental levies, there's so many different ways that we can do that. And that leads us to this program on ecosystem service valuation. It's valuing what nature does for human prosperity and trying to pay an appropriate price to maintain that support, which is, you know, effectively our life system as a human species, so that we do have a future and that, you know, we can, you know, end up on this planet for hopefully a very long period of time.
Wonderful. And how about the local communities? How do your projects affect their well-being?
Ooh, yeah, that's another really interesting question. So if I can speak to the Australian context, in Australia, we were colonized by the British a little over 200 years ago. And one of the things the British did was drain large extents of wetlands. In fact, they drained the equivalent of about 8 million football fields. So you can imagine a ship coming from the other side of the world. This is before the time of planes, and the ships would come into estuaries and they would try and make their way as far inland as they could through the estuary. And they would find a nice deep area to set up a port. And then, of course, what do you know? That port is full of blue carbon ecosystems, seagrasses, tidal marshes, mangroves. And so you start to form a colony and you expand that colony, and people farm around the edge of the coast. You know, for a long time, we've wanted to live around the coast as a nation, and many other nations do. It's the most densely populated areas of the earth around our, a lot of our major cities are based on estuaries and coasts, ships and ports and so on. And so that led to enormous destruction of wetlands. And I think that sentiment around these systems are areas of little productive value probably still exists throughout with many Australians. If I were to say, you know, do you value wetlands? You know, how do you feel about the swamp? They're probably not areas that are well appreciated. You know, even in the English language, we get bogged down in the details. We're swamped with work. There's sort of a negative connotation of wetlands. And, you know, but our Indigenous people, the Aborigines of the land, our traditional custodians of the land, they felt very differently and still do. They've always regarded wetlands as the pharmacies, the hardware stores, the supermarkets. And so what I think we're trying to do here is really, you know, take these systems that aren't very charismatic. It's not like the Great Barrier Reef where people just look at it and get this sense of beauty and appreciation, but we're trying to value these ecosystems in a way that people might not have previously appreciated. Again, coming back to ecosystem service valuation, they're cycling nutrients, they're preventing coast against erosion and extreme weather events, they're supporting our fisheries, they're drawing down carbon, they're removing pollutants. There's so many values that are not recognized, and they need to be recognized within our economic frameworks.
Yeah, interesting that you'd mention also Indigenous people in Australia. So have you been able to maybe include some of them in your activities or any other marginalized or disadvantaged communities?
Sorry, I missed that last part of the question. I think your mute came on a bit early.
Oh, okay, I'll repeat. So it's interesting that you'd mention the perspective of Indigenous communities. Have you been able to maybe include some of them in your activities or any other disadvantaged or marginalized communities?
Yes, we have. We've been, it's something that's very important to us. And I think Australia's coming a long way, still has a long way to go with, you know, understanding how the traditional custodians would like to be engaged in projects respectfully. Even in the restoration work, we have one particular project that's just down the road from me here, where we're working with the Wadawurrung Aboriginal Corporation and undertaking 11 management actions to protect what is the largest cluster of ancestral artifacts in wetlands. And it's been a very rewarding experience, and I think a very humbling experience for us to learn from them the value they get from these ecosystems. You know, Australian culture is just so market driven. You know, it's what is the value of this purely in economic terms? And I think through a traditional owner lens, that's just not what's driving them. And I think it's really refreshing and enlightening for us to engage more with traditional owners to understand, you know, how they feel about the land now and what they would like to see have happen going forward. And if anything, they should really be having an important say in how we approach all the restoration work that's happening.
Yeah, it's really great to hear that you have been able to kind of include that perspective and have partners to work with to include it as well. And you already mentioned that you do citizen science. So how big do you say that the educational component of your work is?
Yeah, so the citizen science work is really important to us. And it's not only a chance to improve climate literacy, but it's a chance to really immerse people in what we do and why we do it. One really good example we have of that is a program we ran that was supported by HSBC Bank. So HSBC Bank is, like a lot of other banks, is investing in sustainable finance. And they wanted to make sure that the people within their organization that are sitting around the board tables who are making huge decisions with finance are understanding how those decisions could impact the planet. You know, are they giving a loan to maybe a coal mine or investing in a group that might, you know, have a large carbon footprint and are doing activities that have an impact on climate change. So one of the things HSBC Bank enlisted us to do was to take out their employees, their senior executives, get them out of their business suits and into gumboots for a day and join us in our research. So we were doing research. We had a series of research questions that we were looking to address, and we were able to bring out about 500 of their employees and their partners across Sydney, Melbourne, and Auckland, and get them in the mud with us to participate in our research. And what was really pleasing to see is that not only were we getting some great research outcomes from the support of having armies of people, we call it Blue Carbon Army. If anybody wants to look it up, type on Twitter, hashtag Blue Carbon Army. But what was great to see was just that we surveyed people months after their participation, and they were making decisions in their life around reducing the carbon footprint, about better recycling, things like that. And that was, I believe, largely due to participation in these immersive experiences, spending a day with a scientist and, you know, getting in the mud, literally, and understanding what we do and why we do it and why it's important.
Yeah, that also sounds very exciting. As we're moving more a little bit more towards the end of the interview, I would like to ask you, like, how scalable do you think that this type of solution is? So you, as we were just chatting a little bit before the interview officially started, you mentioned the problems associated with the blue carbon markets. Maybe you could address a little bit that and how it could be overcome.
I think we're getting better and better estimates of the total scale of opportunity for blue carbon globally. If any of the listeners want to look up a paper we recently published, it's called Blue Carbon as a Natural Climate Solution. And if you hit a paywall, just send me an email and I'll send you a copy of the paper. That was published in Nature Reviews. And we, from that study, found that blue carbon ecosystems store more than 30 billion tons of carbon across 185 million hectares around the world. And we've developed maps showing where the blue carbon hotspots are globally. And importantly, it's not just what we've got, but it's what we could have if we stopped destroying these ecosystems and we restored at wartime speed and scale. So within that paper, and I believe it's quite a conservative estimate, we estimate that if we stop destroying these ecosystems, we could avoid emissions of 304 million tons of CO2 equivalents each year. And if we restored at scale, we could sequester an extra 841 million tons of CO2 a year. Now, if you're, most people would listen to that think, well, what does that mean, right? And it equates to about 3% of global emissions, 3%. So 3% of global emissions could be offset through blue carbon. Now, that might not seem like a lot, but there is no silver bullet for climate change. It's about many, many things coming together to solve the problem. And blue carbon is one of those important solutions. And we get a lot of bang for our restoration buck when it comes to blue carbon. As I mentioned, it's not just the carbon, it's biodiversity, it's coastal protection, it's fisheries, it's recreation, it's tourism, it's cultural values, and so on.
So would you say that you are hopeful about the whole climate crisis and carbon problem?
Depends what day you catch me on. And I probably go around in circles a little bit on this. Some days I feel incredibly depressed and other days I'm quite optimistic. I think what's starting to happen is some, you know, I feel like there's some incredible change that's starting to happen. We're not where we need to be, of course. But I think you can, every time we have a major COP event, we're getting better and better. But this window of maybe 10 years is, you know, to avoid dangerous climate change is rapidly closing ahead of us. But it's the awareness, it's the podcasts like this that give people a sense of hope, but also a solemn view of the seriousness of this issue. You know, I'm coming across few and few climate deniers these days, which is a very, very good thing. And, you know, for me, blue carbon's been one of those good news stories. You know, we're on the hunt for systems that are important for carbon capture and storage, and nature's way is often best. You know, we talk about CCS, and I'm sure you're probably covering that in your podcast in this series. And, you know, for me, I'm really supportive of natural climate solutions because of so many of those benefits to lives and livelihoods. One of the challenges we've got with natural climate solutions is that they're only receiving about 3% of global climate investment, yet it's estimated they could achieve a third of all climate change mitigation needed to keep global warming under 2 degrees Celsius by 2030. So an important part of the solution, but I wouldn't say we've operationalized many natural climate solutions to date, blue carbon being one of them.
And finally, for anyone watching that would be inspired or concerned, what could people do to support the cause or even potentially get involved in some of your activities?
Oh, well, hopefully you've fallen in love with blue carbon and you'll tell someone else and they'll tell someone else. That's an important start. And perhaps you live near a wetland and you know that wetland is maybe under threat from development, and you'll be prepared to maybe speak up about that. What can you do practically in the blue carbon space? Well, I think it's an emerging field. The term blue carbon was only coined in 2009. I think we need a lot more scientists, a lot more students coming through to support what is this really important next phase in the blue carbon world, which is putting all the science into on-ground action, you know, restoration at really large scales. So if you happen to be in a position to support that, either the development of the science or the translation of that science into policy and practice, then I think please start looking into blue carbon as and where you might fit. I'm sorry, that's probably a really vague and non-specific answer. It's a difficult question to answer.
No, I think that's actually quite a concrete answer. Thank you so much for sharing these perspectives with us today. And for anyone watching, you can find in the description the links to Blue Carbon Lab and to the paper that Professor McCready just mentioned. So please do take a look at them. And thank you again so much for being here today.
Thanks, Carolina.